Architect Stephen Dietman joins us this morning. He is an architect, artist, musician, and writer living in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He's an expert at green design and making spaces simultaneously economical and exciting. He also does a monthly column for Architecture and Arcadia magazine. To discuss these many issues with us, we welcome Stephen Dietman to the roundtable this morning. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Joe. Thanks.
What got you into this field?
Well, I had wanted to be an artist initially, and like a lot of people from my generation, when the notion of college came up, my parents were strongly in favor of an architectural education. And so I did, and I'm glad I did.
And you have been able to really put the two together in the sense of, and before I get there, architecture is, there is an art to that, right?
I mean, absolutely.
It is an artistic pursuit.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really what I want to say, is that this division between all these, you know, art and architecture, it's a false division. And when I realized that, I thought, well, bring them together. That's the whole point.
So there is what you want artistically, and then I assume there is also what you can do architecturally, and that's the balance.
Absolutely, there is a balance. I mean, architecture is ultimately, there's a great deal of technical aspects to it, and those have to be respected. Obviously, the house has to stand, it has to keep out the weather, but it has to do more than that. And that's sort of the difference between, I think, just plain building and what we call architecture. Not to put too fine a point on it, but something that goes beyond just the sort of prerequisites of a building.
When you start a project, because there is that idea of, for you as an architect, that you can be an artist, but there is also the client who is going to say, well, I want this building to look pedestrian. I want it to look normal. I want it to look, and maybe that do you find that squashes your creativity?
No. I think, first of all, the client is a critical part of this. You can't do good architecture without a good client.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, they're putting up the money.
Absolutely.
And it's not so much, it's not much about style, the way that they want it to look per se, although obviously that's important to me. But I think one of the things that I have to do right away is that I have to, we're collaborating on this. I'm not imposing anything. I wouldn't want to, and I couldn't. But I really want to work in some kind of a fashion that when we walk away, we're both happy with the result. And creativity allows for many, many approaches. And the nature of the way that I work is to basically try to read their minds and try to understand what they're looking for. And not just not just the practical sense. I mean, obviously there's got to be enough storage. They have to have the rooms they want, the number of bedrooms, that kind of a thing. And my focus is primarily residential. But to go beyond that and to show them things that they might not have envisioned. I mean, my role is not to simply say, as a draftsman, just, well, I'll draw out what you're thinking. I want to show them options. If they don't like them, we talk more, and we come to some kind of an agreement. And that's a critical part of the way that I work, and how I think architects should work.
When you mention residential, that is certainly a dream on a part of someone of what they want their home space, this very intimate, personal place to be.
Right.
And then you also there to realize what to offer ideas and to offer what is possible and to perhaps, you know, give a little nod and say, yes, this can work and this can't. For people who come to you, what do you think they're looking for? I mean, you have a name and people know what you do and what is on your resume. So for when the type of client who is coming to you, what do you think they have in common?
Well, the good thing about being at this point in my career is that they have an idea of what I do. And that sort of vets people automatically. And the ones that come tend to want to do the kind of playful, small, carefully designed houses, well thought out, because you're substituting a sort of space, say from the McMansion concept, to as little as you can build and live in comfortably. But more than that, they're willing to engage in this process, and it is a process of self-discovery. And to really understand who they are and how they want to live. You know, in the end, people want to live in houses. The people that come to me want to live in a house that really reflects the way they are living and the way they want to live, and not the way typically people basically accede to living in someone else's box and sort of adjusting themselves to it. If they come to me, they're looking to start from scratch, from the ground up, and make it their house, as custom as it can be. One of those, it's an amazing process to watch as people sort of realize, yes, you know, I've always wanted this sort of a thing, but I didn't realize it was even possible, this arrangement or this layout or this connection to the landscaping. And I try to get them exactly what they want within their budget, obviously.
Your website is sgddesign.com, and on there you have a page in the architecture that you do, and people can refer to it. And I'm going to talk about one particular project, so if people want to see it, they can.
Sure.
And that is the Scribner House, and this is a project that you did back in 2004.
Right.
And, you know, when I first saw it, I didn't have a description next to it, and I said, oh, well, you know, it looks like a caboose. And then I thought, oh, I'm being derogatory. And then I'm reading your comments, and you're like, no, I wanted it to look like a caboose. And I thought, well, that's really cool. That's great.
Thank you.
I felt like an idiot. Like I'm like, oh man, it looks like a caboose. And then you think you're being like a bad art critic, you know. And then you turn around and say, oh no, I wanted it to look like a caboose.
You know, you're seeing the obvious, and that's here. I had a small piece of land, and it was right on the railroad tracks, and 90% of people doing a house there would have said, no railroad tracks. Let's basically hide from that reality. I've always loved trains. I never had a problem with trains. You know, in Great Barrington, that train comes through twice a day. It's a joy to me. And so I said, well, why not? And because so much of architectural design is metaphoric. You're borrowing from the site. You're borrowing from the surrounding, the context. Well, the one of the major aspects of this site was the railroad train. And I wanted to pick cues, visual cues from it, to build this house.
And you take with that the obstacles being it's a small house.
Very small.
You don't have a lot of area to work with, and it's a steep, steep slope. So many people would look at that and say, we can't make that. That isn't going to work for what we need.
Absolutely. I mean, the site was everything. The site was, as you said, very steep. Basically going down to railroad tracks. But if you look more carefully, if anyone who looked at that site, and it was for sale for a long time, is they would have seen that beyond it was the Housatonic River floodplain, which could never be built on.
Yeah.
And that was basically one of the most beautiful natural habitats, you know, around. Yours there for the watching, and further beyond were the Berkshire Mountains. So if you could get beyond the block of saying, well, it goes to the railroad tracks, and actually realize, as you said, that you're entering the house from the upper level. And this was one of those houses where the bedrooms drop below, because it makes much more sense to come in off the carport and enter right into the house, and the view is straight out through, so that you're always aware that you have this amazingly beautiful place, the Berkshires, all around you, these mountains. And then when it's time to sleep, downstairs you go, and you have a certain amount of privacy by being below.
And it has a steel structure, and you decided to keep that mostly exposed.
I did. I for a bunch of reasons. One is that the steel siding is virtually zero maintenance. And, you know, I wanted to make a house that had very little lawn and very little maintenance, because those are the two things that I thought were going to be important. And I actually built it for myself, but it was bought by a man named George Scribner, who loves it, and who essentially, as you're going back to your earlier question, you know, when you design a house like this, it's basically someone's going to love it, or they're not going to be interested. And this house, basically, he loved, and he's done work on it since as well.
It also, and I find this with your work, where it has two things. And I don't mean this to be negative, but you look at some architects, and you can tell what they do, because everything sort of looks
right.
alike,
right.
And I have this artist these artistic discussions with authors a lot where they say, you know, the last thing we want to do is have a book, you know, you could write that book and I could write that book 50 times and I'd probably sell 8 million copies, but I don't want to write that book because I've already written that book. The thing I find interesting about your work is that it all really looks different. I mean, it isn't like a Frank Gehry type thing of you say, oh, okay, well, that's, you know, that's a Gehry. This is very eclectic and really there's no fundamental stamp that's your work.
That is perfectly said. I don't want to start with preconceptions. I want these buildings to organically emerge, and they emerge as a result of what the people want.
Yeah.
What the site permits, budget. I mean, again, architecture, all these constraints, and you don't want to start with any more assumptions than you have to. You want to let the building design itself as much as possible. And that's what I try to do, so that this house will be different than a house on another site with another client. It's just going to be different. And if it isn't, there's, I think, a problem.
I mentioned in the introduction, I know this is something that you work with, and that is green design.
Yes.
And that is something that I assume clients are coming to you and are willing to not make sacrifices but to look at that as an alternative to more traditional building materials and ideas.
That's right. I mean, I think the reality is that it's moving in that direction. You'll see the change in codes, the adoption of the stretch code in a lot of communities, particularly in Massachusetts, where they're getting more and more stringent about energy. But essentially, you look at the cost of a building, and if you just look at the cost of the construction, you're only getting a partial. What you need to see is the cost of, what I tell people is, look at the cost of the building plus 10 years. How much is it going to cost you to live in that building for 10 years? What are the energy costs? What are the maintenance costs? They're not initial capital costs, but they're part of living in that house. And you have to be realistic about it. So I'm really pushing for small, carefully designed houses where as little as you need to live comfortably and live the life you want to live, but no more, no excess. And that's, I talk a little bit about the beauty of airplane and ship design, where you don't want any more space than you need because you're going to have to lift it off the ground or move it through the water. That kind of thinking has to come into architectural design.
One of the things that strikes me, again, when I was asking you before about this, of given that it's, you work so much with the residential and it's a person's home and it's so personal and it's an intimate space. My wife and I have a very small house.
Right.
It has a hell of a view. Mm. I mean, it's a great view, and but it's a small house.
Right.
And it's one level, and it's just the two of us, and it's pretty perfect. I mean, you know, I have more stuff in there than I could certainly need to get rid of. What do you think? And I don't mean to go off into social commentary here, but I'm. You've said it a couple of times about small livable space, and versus the McMansion, where what is it of that excess of that expanse that many people think that they need, where it's a couple and one child, and you need three stories.
Yeah, this is really the puzzling thing to me, because the idea of building just what you need is, and by the way, you can't help going into social commentary on this. There's so many tentacles to when you build, and I think one of the critical things is that every building, you know, Churchill said we shape our cities, and our cities shape us. That's true of our houses, true of everything we build, and I think that you're going to be making, you know, I think Alan talks about the notion of politics as the allocation of scarce resources.
Yes.
It's exactly what architecture is. And you begin to see, how are people allocating those resources? Who has them? Who doesn't? But equally important is, when they're building it, what are they building? Are they building a fortress? Is a McMansion literally a fortress? Is it a fear-based building? And I think that if you look at a culture where it seems to be oftentimes every man for himself, people are trying to build the best fortress they can to hedge against whatever's coming. But this is a vast discussion about what buildings mean and the sort of understory that isn't often discussed, because every building does have an understory. It has meaning. It relates to the world in some fashion. It tells everybody what they're seeing, what they want, and the way the building will act with the other buildings in the whole world.
Mm. You think about the way we go. Because my wife works for an architecture firm, and much of their work, not all certainly, but a large portion of their work is working with historic preservation,
right,
and working with what is there,
right,
and or adaptive reuse,
right,
and of taking the things that are there and not having to build something new,
right,
but to use what we have, which in many cases from bygone eras are gorgeous structures.
Absolutely. Adaptive reusing buildings is a critical part of conservation. I think that in my case, a lot of South County, there aren't any available buildings. You know, there's just everything has been bought up and a large part of the usage is there. So people are looking for something new because they have to. There are buildings. I'm not saying there's not houses for sale, but maybe that small group of houses didn't work for them. You know, adaptive reuse, I encourage people strongly to do that. That is certainly the most green thing you can do, all other things being equal. But building a small, carefully designed house, that's the second greenest thing you can do.
And there's always possibility.
And there's always possibility, exactly.
Stephen Dietman is an architect and artist. You can go to sgddesign.com for more information. It's his website, and you can find out about his art and about his architecture. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.